Here is news on China. John Carter Vincent of the State Department reports that our effort to unify China is not altruistic, but is a realistic national policy, and that sound business practice will guide extension of credits to China. Representative Judd of Minnesota suggests temporary joint United Nations trusteeship of Manchuria as safeguard against future wars. Representative Hugh DeLacy of Washington charges that the Chinese government has failed to live up to its commitments as a coalition government. The NBC University of the Air presents Our Foreign Policy, a weekly discussion of international issues by leading Washington officials. This is a special broadcast originating at a meeting of the Foreign Policy Association in Springfield, Massachusetts. Our policy in China will be discussed by Mr. John Carter Vincent, Director of the State Department's Office of Far Eastern Affairs, and two outstanding congressional authorities on this question, Representatives Walter Judd of Minnesota and Hugh DeLacy of Washington State. Sterling Fisher, Director of the NBC University of the Air, will serve as chairman. Mr. Vincent and Mr. Fisher are speaking from Springfield. Because of a special session of Congress, Congressman Judd and DeLacy are speaking from Washington. Now, Mr. Fisher.
We Americans have learned from bitter experience that there can be no real peace in the world unless there is peace in the Far East and especially in China. You gentlemen represent the expert opinion of our Congress and State Department, and we want to learn from you the exact aims of our China policy, how it's shaping up, and whether or not it's working. Mr. Vincent, as director of the State Department's Far Eastern Office, do you think the renewal of fighting in Manchuria means that our policy in China is a failure?
Not at all, Mr. Fisher. It is discouraging, but I believe Chinese common sense, together with the wise counsel of General Marshall, will prevail and bring about restoration of peace.
Representative DeLacy, you've been very critical of our China policy in the past. What do you think of it now?
Just before Representative DeLacy answers that question, here is a bulletin from the NBC newsroom in Washington. The House overwhelmingly voted power for President Truman today to draft men for industry in emergencies and penalize strikers against the government. And now, Representative DeLacy.
To answer Mr. Fisher's question, our China policy is fine. President Truman's statement of last December made our position clear. The Chinese government must make a sincere effort to achieve unity before we will help them further. The question is, are we following the policy that we laid down, or are we throwing all our support to the national government at the very moment when it is breaking the pledges it has made to General Marshall?
Well now, Dr. Judd, you were in China for many years as a medical missionary. And as an old China hand, what do you think of the chances for attaining unity?
I'd say General Marshall's apparent success at first was greater than anyone could reasonably have expected under the circumstances. Whether or not he can actually succeed in bringing the substance rather than just the appearance of unity to China is another matter. As for the presidential statement of last December, I hope its meaning is clearer to General Marshall than it is to some others.
President Truman's statement of policy was thoroughly discussed with General Marshall before it was issued. It called for cessation of civil strife in China, formation of a coalition government, and unification of the armed forces as a basis for American aid to China.
Now, Dr. Judd, what is unclear about that?
If it means only what it appears to mean, I'm certainly all in favor of it. But there is a catch in it in the last paragraph, which suggests that if unity is not achieved, we won't help the legitimate Chinese government, no matter who is at fault. This encourages the Chinese communists in their disruptive activities. It tells them that if Chiang Kai-shek does not cooperate faithfully, we won't support him. If the communists do not cooperate faithfully, we still won't support him. Therefore, the statement could be and was interpreted by many Chinese as favoring the communists and threatening to Jiang. It made General Marshall's task more difficult, because no free government likes a threat from outside.
Mr. Vincent, what is the exact wording of the passage Dr. Judd is referring to?
It reads, I quote, "As China moves towards peace and unity, the United States would be prepared to assist the national government in every reasonable way to rehabilitate the country, improve the agrarian and industrial economy, and establish a military organization capable of discharging China's national and international responsibilities for the maintenance of peace and order."
I'd like to disagree with Dr. Judd's interpretation of this paragraph.
Go ahead, Mr. DeLacy.
President Truman's statement, I firmly believe, was the main basis for General Marshall's initial success in bringing the central government and communist leaders together. You have to realize what kind of civil war it was that broke out after VJ Day. To the reactionary elements of the central government,
It meant an opportunity to wipe out political opposition on the assumption that unlimited American supplies would be forthcoming with no strings attached. This assumption grew out of former Ambassador Hurley's transparent favoritism for the central government party. The presence of American troops and American assistance to one side only encouraged the government to use armed force to try to destroy the communists, as it had tried unsuccessfully to do for 10 years before the war. As for Dr. Judd's fear that the communists will resist unity, let me remind my distinguished colleague that they have proposed on several occasions that an unconditional truce be declared in the fighting to make way for negotiations. The nationalists have so far refused all offers. How much more aggressive would the central government be if American aid had remained unconditional?
Let's go back a little now on the matter of the truce. We were all pretty hopeful for a time because of the January armistice, but now fighting has broken out again and is spreading from all the reports. Mr. Vincent, what's the story behind the truce and its breakdown?
The truce was concluded on January the 10th between the central government and the Communist Party. General Marshall was mediator. The truce terms included cessation of all hostilities and, except in certain specific cases, all troop movements in China. On the same day, the political consultative conference was convened in Chongqing by the Chinese government. It was composed of delegates representing all shades of political opinion, including the Communists and the Liberal Party, the Democratic Federation. Political and military unity were to be worked out simultaneously, since it had been shown that they could not be dealt with separately.
And what political agreements were reached?
Provision was made for a coalition government and for the adoption of a democratic constitution. There were guarantees of freedom of speech, of person, assembly, and publication. There was recognition of the equality and legality of all political parties. There was an agreement to promote local self-government by conducting popular elections, and an agreement to release all political prisoners with the exception of those guilty of treason against the state. It was a sort of continental congress for China. Its actions represented a long step forward toward Chinese democracy.
And after such a fine start, what happened? Dr. Judd, can you tell us?
The communists have repeatedly broken part of the agreement, indicating that they agreed to sign it only because, as on several similar occasions previously, they needed to play for time and a chance to get some arms. They used that time to strengthen themselves. They tore up the railroads in North China and blocked Jiang's entrance into Manchuria, even though they had specifically agreed not to obstruct, and I quote, the movement of the national government's troops into and within the 9 provinces in the northeast of China, that is Manchuria, for the purpose of restoring Chinese sovereignty, end of quote.
But weren't the Russians in control of Manchuria?
Yes, but they broke the treaty they had made with China only last August by preventing landing of Jiang's troops at Dairen. During the months when Chinese troops were kept out in violation of the agreements, the communists moved thousands of their troops into Manchuria. The Russians, in disarming the Japanese in Manchuria, systematically turned Japanese arms over to Chinese villagers, at times and places where the communists could move in quickly and get those arms. If Jiang moved his troops in accordance with the agreement, he was accused of taking aggressive action. When the communists, in violation of the agreement, resisted his troops, and even on one occasion shelled them for 3 days with 6-inch Japanese cannon, that was apparently quite all right. Now, just how can Jiang or anyone be expected to trust their word again?
Mr. DeLacy, do you agree with that explanation of why the armistice failed?
Not at all, Mr. Fisher. Some of the fault probably lies on both sides. But the greater violation is on the nationalist side.
What's your evidence for that?
Well, the truce agreement and the resolutions at the political consultative conference laid the foundation for national unity. Since then, the Generalissimo has repudiated most of the compromise agreements. He broke the agreement on the composition of the armed forces and failed to call a constitutional assembly.
But only after the communists refused to take part in the assembly and themselves asked a postponement.
Yes, but the Democratic League and the communists both refused for a very good reason. Their newspaper offices and party meeting places in nationalist China have been attacked in violation of the guarantees of freedom of speech and press and of the legal status of all political parties. The Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, the Central Executive Committee, undermined the decisions to have popular elections and to promote local self-government. The government has not only not released political prisoners, but many of them have died mysteriously in jail since the agreement was signed. The Communists and the Democratic League argue, in view of these facts, that if the Nationalists take over completely in Manchuria, they will only extend their old dictator form of government to all of Manchuria.
The communists are no angels so far as civil liberties are concerned. They permit only one point of view in the areas they dominate. Their regime is completely totalitarian. I suspect history may record that Generalissimo's greatest mistake was in not liquidating the communists in 1937 when he had the chance.
But that was when Japan was opening her attack on China.
Exactly. The communists were right in the path of the Japanese attack. They would have been caught in the middle.
But Dr. Judd, that would have meant turning China over to the Japanese in order to get rid of the Chinese communists. And I'm sure Generalissimo Zheng realized this.
Certainly he realized it. That's exactly why he trusted the communists and tried to get unity with them against Japan.
You must remember that the Chinese communist movement is a social as well as a political and military movement. The national government tried to eradicate it for 10 years without success.
But in 1937, for the first time, the communists were surrounded on all sides, and they were greatly weakened. That's why they consented to a truce then.
The reason Zhang has never been able to stamp out the communist movement in China is that it has done a lot more for the people than the central government.
Just what has it done, Mr. DeLacy?
It's abolished usury, cut taxes, stopped the arbitrary collection of taxes years in advance, and given the peasants a fairer share of the crops they produce, to name just a few of the reforms.
But so did the national government carry out far-reaching reforms in the years 1932 to 37. After that, it was too busy fighting a war.
The national government is now faced with the imperative task of improving a lot of the Chinese masses, of making much-needed agrarian reforms, in short, of proving that it can govern for the people.
Most of the reforms of which Dr. Judd speaks were in the line of building roads and railroads. They were for military purposes.
No, indeed. They also made tremendous progress in public schools, health education, opium eradication, bandit suppression, and so forth.
Then, Dr. Judd, why is there so much popular resistance to the national government in North China and Manchuria?
Who says there is much popular resistance? I received just this week a letter from an American in Beiping, a man who knows the Chinese well. He wrote, quote, "I have not yet met with any Chinese who has come to Beiping out of the communist-occupied areas who has anything good to say about the communists. They all seem to be against it." And that's the end of the quote. Actually, neither side has given what we would call good government.
But what about Manchuria?
Don't forget, Dr. Judd, that Manchuria was more or less autonomous under the old warlords up to the time Japan came in. The communists work for a large degree of provincial autonomy in the areas they control. That appeals to the Chinese in Manchuria.
I was in Manchuria in 1931, and it was an integral part of China. Naturally, the communists want the very great advantage of having their own autonomous government and also a share in the national government. I can't blame them for wanting both, but I can blame us if we help them get both.
Mr. Vincent, which interpretation do you think jibes best with the State Department's information?
Actually, Mr. Fisher, the picture is not at all black and white. The Kuomintang makes a strong case against the communists for their activities in Manchuria. On the other hand, the communists make an equally strong case against the Kuomintang for its obstructive attitude toward the decisions of the People's Council.
There are reports, Mr. Vincent, that the Democratic League has offered one proposal to end the fighting in Manchuria, a proposal which was acceptable to both General Marshall and the communists, but which the Generalissimo refused. He prefers to fight for undisputed control. Negotiations would mean sharing control with Manchurian leaders. And I don't like the fact that the army which he is using in Manchuria, the new First Army, was trained and equipped and transported by the United States.
Well, Mr. DeLacy, since it was we who promised Manchuria should go back to the national government of China, certainly we would rather be transporting Chinese troops to take it back than transporting American troops to take it back.
I'm not in favor of using either kind of troops.
But after Secretary Burns' speech last Monday night, surely you are not suggesting that we should go back on a solemn commitment.
All I'm suggesting, Dr. Judd, is that we use all our power and prestige to bring about peace in China and not to back up one side or the other in their civil war.
Naturally, the communists would like a truce now when they have occupied 60% of Manchuria. But how can Jiang properly make another deal with them on either military or political matters in Manchuria until the process of restoring Chinese sovereignty there is completed?
Then what solution would you suggest, Dr. Judd?
The situation is now so complicated and so dangerous to world peace that I believe the best solution, if it can be agreed to by all concerned, would be a temporary joint trusteeship by the United Nations over Manchuria until real unity is achieved in China proper. Two wars have started in Manchuria. It is a veritable tinderbox again.
That's an interesting suggestion, a United Nations trusteeship in Manchuria, if the Soviet Union or some other nation doesn't veto it in the Security Council.
That's the main obstacle.
Now, Mr. Vincent, come back to the question of whether the truce can be extended to Manchuria.
I think it can be, Mr. Fisher, and that it will be. Happily, there is usually in China a political or practical solution for a military situation.
The military situation in Manchuria is due in large part to our blunder in not firmly insisting that Russia live up to her treaty and allow Chinese troops to land at Dairen. Because we didn't exercise such vigorous and steady leadership then, Manchuria is in danger of becoming a second Poland. The same kind of civil conflict and tragic confusion is likely to spread to all of North China and then to other parts of Asia. If we do not stand firmly now, not against Russia, but for the sovereignty, the independence, the territorial, and the administrative integrity of China. That is the classic statement of American policy toward China. It was reaffirmed in unequivocal terms by the Cairo Declaration, to which Russia herself pledged adherence at Potsdam, and again in the Moscow communique last December. The communists are armed rebels trying to overthrow that sovereign Chinese government. In addition, there is ample reason to believe their primary allegiance is not to their own people.
You made some strong statements there, Dr. Judd. But what about the charges that the national government has taken over the Chinese puppets who had given their allegiance to Japan and has absorbed them into the central government forces?
I read in the New York Post recently that about 600,000 Quisling soldiers, or 72 divisions, have purchased their immunity from the normal penalties of treason by being absorbed into the nationalist forces. This was in China proper, and there were supposed to be about 200,000 more puppet troops in Manchuria.
I don't think taking them over need cause as much worry as allowing them to run loose as bandits. I never knew of Chinese puppet troops who were actually loyal to the Japanese.
Now, Mr. Vincent, I'd like to hear your opinion on a point to which Dr. Judd has touched on twice. That is the actions of the Russian troops in Manchuria. Just what are the facts about Soviet intervention there?
There are strong indications, Mr. Fisher, that the Russian troops did what Dr. Judd charged, turned over captured Japanese arms to the Chinese villagers and peasants, instead of waiting for the central government troops to arrive. When the Russians evacuated Manchuria, these local people had the advantage. They were all over Manchuria and had quicker access to the evacuated places and to the arms.
Now, let's not forget, though, that the people of Manchuria have suffered under the Japanese twice as long as anyone else in China since 1931. They want to be liberated, but they don't want to be conquered all over again by new outsiders, even if the new outsiders are Chinese. They resented the inefficient and dictatorial advance agents who were sent in by the central government. The communists are mobilizing the peasants to bring about the reforms pledged in the official Kuomintang program and suppressed and practiced by Chiang Kai-shek, his Gestapo, and the warlords. This is why they are winning popular support against Zhang's troops.
Well, it seems clear that neither side is wholly at fault or wholly blameless either.
There's another very important reason for the breakdown of the truce, Mr. Fisher, which hasn't been mentioned. I don't think it can be separated from the state of power politics in the world. When the Kuomintang reactionaries saw the way things were going in the United Nations Security Council, the controversies with Russia over Iran and Spain, and the general lack of unity, they no longer felt any great pressure to straighten out their own affairs. So long as the great nations fail to work together toward peace, and especially so long as the two greatest nations, the United States and the Soviet Union, fail to work together, we can't expect fascist-minded groups in China or any place else to give up any of the power they have enjoyed for so long. They will just keep hoping for an open break between the great nations, which they believe will ensure American support regardless of their internal politics.
This brings up a question worth going into. From all you gentlemen have said, it seems clear that China's political troubles are not entirely internal because Russia and the United States are exerting their influence in China in different directions. Mr. Vincent, if Russia supports the communists and the United States supports only the central government, aren't China's chances for internal unity undermined?
Undermined, Mr. Fisher, is an understatement, I'm afraid. Our policy has, of course, been to deal with the central government as the recognized government of China, our aid to China has gone to the central government, not the communists. But the aid we give the central government is certainly not intended to be used for purposes of civil war. Our efforts are and will continue to be to bring about a unified China. It was with that thought in mind that Mr. Byrne obtained an agreement in Moscow last December emphasizing, and I quote, the need for a unified and democratic China under the national government, for broad participation by democratic elements in all branches of the national government, and for a cessation of civil strife.
Under a coalition government, the various minor parties would have a chance to grow. The key is representative government based on free elections and dedicated to reform of the landlord system and the liberation of China from Chiang Kai-shek's present dictatorship.
General Marshall's plan for the amalgamation of both government and communist troops into a single unified armed force was heartily endorsed by the Generalissimo and accepted by the communists. Under this plan, no political party would have an armed force as an instrument to further its objectives. The troops would be mixed up together in a national defense army for the whole of China and would lose their party affiliations.
Mr. Vincent, all that sounds very plausible and certainly is desirable. And as you say, the national government agreed to the plan, hoping, despite its past experiences, that the communists would act in good faith. But I warn that no one should be surprised if the maneuver produces quite different results from those intended.
How so, Dr. Judd?
Because before the military strength of the communists is reduced, their political opportunity is greatly enlarged. It may turn out that General Marshall did a disservice to China and to America by helping give the communists freedom to propagandize all over China instead of just in a localized area in the north. Let no one be so naive as to imagine that just because the Chinese communists have signed a unity pact with the central government and have agreed to army unification, they don't intend to get complete control of China eventually.
On one point, Dr. Judd, General Marshall did not insist that the Generalissimo accept the plan. On the contrary, the Generalissimo insisted that an integration of the armies was essential to Chinese unity. General Marshall was in full agreement with him.
President Yong must have recognized the risk Dr. Judd mentioned when he agreed to a coalition government and a unified army.
Yes, he did. And a good many in his government felt that he had risked too much in taking this means to appease the communists.
General Marshall recognized the risks, too, but he must have decided that since neither army was strong enough to wipe the other out, there would be the same kind of settling down process under a unity program as other democracies have experienced, with communists and other opposition groups taking their places in the government along with the Kuomintang. There could be a leavening effect on all groups. The communists would be making compromises as well as the Kuomintang. Politically, I should suppose it would be the in-between groups who would profit most.
I do not view the situation in the light of either political profit or appeasement. Neither the Kuomintang nor the communists can bring enduring unity to China by force of arms or by political propaganda. They are faced with the very heavy responsibility of deciding whether they wish to be top dogs in areas of a disunited and possibly warring China, or whether they wish to cooperate in achieving what all China and the world want, a united, cooperative China. This requires give and take on both sides. General Marshall is striving mightily, and I might add daily and nightly, to supply the incentive and reason for such a spirit of give and take.
I'd like to go a little deeper into the controversial issue of the reported $500 million American credit to China.
I don't see anything controversial about that, Mr. Fisher. If the national government does not cooperate faithfully in keeping its agreements and in working for unity, then we certainly should not support it with a loan or with anything else. But if it does cooperate faithfully and the communists continue to break their pledges, then we should support the national government wholeheartedly. It is a matter both of our national honor and of concern for peace and our own best interests in Asia. I am firmly convinced that the surest way to avoid large-scale civil war in China is for the United States to continue to give full support to our ally, the national government, unless or until there is evidence it is not acting in good faith. Since Russia has pledged both moral and material assistance to that government also, for her to object would be to reveal openly that she was not sincere in her promises to China and to us. It is hard for me to believe she would want to do that.
One moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, our foreign policy coming to you this evening from Springfield, Massachusetts and Washington, D.C., has been interrupted due to conditions beyond our control. We shall return you to the program as soon as possible, but in the meantime, we offer a musical interlude from our New York studio.
He mentioned earlier, prior to our discussion for this broadcast,
that we had radioed an appeal from the Democratic League. And that appeal says unequivocally that a loan to China now would only go to finance military action by the central government against the opposition. The Democratic League asked the committee, Mr. DeLacy says, to see to it that the credit is not granted until after the establishment of a genuine democratic coalition government in China. Now, Mr. DeLacy's question next is if this money is not used for civil war purposes, but for rehabilitation and reconstruction in China, what would be his view?
All Chinese would welcome a credit for the reconstruction of their country. But they fear that if a loan is granted while the present unrepresentative regime is still in power, it will be used for whatever purposes that regime chooses.
Can you clear up this question for us, Mr. Vincent?
Well, I'd like to talk business instead of ideologies or political objectives for a moment. Mr. Truman, in his statement of December the 15th, said that the United States, quote, would be prepared to give favorable consideration to Chinese requests for credits and loans for projects which would contribute toward the development of a healthy economy throughout China and healthy trade relations between China and the United States. Credits to a disunited and potentially war-torn China would manifestly not be good business or good use of the taxpayers' money. I might add that the uses to which an overall credit are put have to meet the approval of the Export-Import Bank. When conditions indicate that it will be advantageous for us to do so, I believe we should give all practical financial assistance to China to enable the Chinese to reconstruct their economy and regain their peacetime trade in civilian commodities.
Mr. Vincent, do you have any clues to the state of American public opinion on our China policy?
No opinion poll figures, but the State Department's Office of Public Affairs has made a pretty thorough study of opinion as expressed in the press and on the radio.
And what is the consensus of opinion as to the future?
There's a very real desire for a democratic coalition government in China, and also general recognition that the Soviet Union should cooperate in working out its solution for relations in the Far East.
Well, to summarize, we have a sharp division of opinion here on the blame for the present disorders in China and Manchuria. Dr. Judd, you place the primary blame on the maneuvers of the communists. Mr. DeLacy, you say the central government has failed to live up to its commitments. But all of you agree that unity is desirable from the point of view of American security and world peace, and that General Marshall's efforts in this direction should be supported. Does that sum it up, Mr. Vincent?
I think that's about it. Our efforts to bring about peace and unity in China are not altruistic. They are in furtherance of our clear national and international interests. After all, it was a disunited China which encouraged Japanese aggression in 1931. This led directly to all-out war upon us in 1941. Dr. Judd has rightly pointed out that we must stand for the independence and the territorial and administrative integrity of China. But we cannot again place our sole reliance upon the self-denying principles of the Open Door and the Nine-Power Treaty. We must make positive efforts to bring about a strong, united China. The issue is not whether our efforts result in full-blown unity overnight. It is whether, in the face of the obvious difficulties, we can afford to abandon our efforts to bring about unity or to alter their direction. I feel strongly, therefore, that keeping apart from partisan Chinese politics, we should continue to give General Marshall our confidence and backing in carrying out the great task which he has undertaken in the long-term interests of this country, of China, and of international peace.
That was John Carter Vincent, Director of the State Department's Office of Far Eastern Affairs. He has been discussing our policy in China with Representative Walter Judd of Minnesota, Representative Hugh DeLacy of the State of Washington, and Sterling Fisher, Director of the NBC University of the Air. The discussion was arranged and adopted for radio by Selden and Audrey Menifee. This broadcast originated at a meeting of the Foreign Policy Association in Springfield, Massachusetts. This has been the 66th in a weekly series of broadcasts presented by the NBC University of the Air and transmitted to our servicemen and women overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio.